To our third case of this morning, United States against Etchen and others. Mr. Delia, are you the first one up?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Anthony Delia and I represent Catrice Etchen. What I hope is clear in my brief is that the district court made a clear error of fact, and it was a significant fact, when the court found that once Etchen learned that drug agents wanted to search the apartment for Bowman's crack, the cat was out of the bag. That simply is not true and is not supported in the record.
But let me ask you this question, Mr. Delia. Under Segura, isn't the critical fact whether at the time the police officers show up at the apartment, which I realize is late in the night, do they at that time have probable cause to get the warrant? Because actually we're kind of operating on two paths. They're at the apartment, they knock, they're hoping for consent, they don't get it. Meantime, the other officer is off there tracking down the state court judge and eventually around 3:30 or so getting the warrant. As long as there was probable cause, and it was the same probable cause that's presented to the issuing judge, doesn't Segura say that you can go in and, if you will, seize the apartment as long as you're not searching, secure the apartment?
Segura actually requires that there was probable cause to believe that evidence would be destroyed as well.
I'm not sure it does actually say that. It certainly requires probable cause to search the apartment, even though you can't start the search until you get the warrant. But I'm not sure. And on top of that, I suppose if we go down the exigency route with drug cases, I find it difficult to believe if the officers had knocked on the door and then left Ms. Etchen alone for 3 hours, she wouldn't have disposed of the drugs. But be that as it may, I'm not sure that that's the legal standard.
Okay. I believe, Your Honor, that it is the legal standard, but even were it not, I would still like to briefly go through the exigent circumstances or the lack thereof.
Okay.
Because any exigency that was created would have been created by the police by showing up at that door anyway. So I think that the very best fact to show that there was no exigency was the fact that the police decided, we'll go, we'll ask for permission, and then if she doesn't give us permission, we'll force our way in, and then we'll go get a warrant.
But why? But you're not saying it was unlawful for the police to go knock on the door, are you?
No, I think that it was absolutely lawful for the police to knock on the door, but I think that the police were well aware of this court's decision.
Well, doesn't your whole case depend on the Collins case?
I think that it does. I think that Collins is a very strong case in support of Ms. Etchen's opinion.
I mean, how is this case any different from Collins? I should have asked that of your opponent. I'm asking you the view to start with.
Actually, my opponent argues that it is significantly different. He says that it was that this case is a seizure under Segura and the other one was a search. But I think that the protected interest here is the initial entry into Ms. Etchen's door. That's what the Constitution provided the protection for, and I think that that's the most important thing.
But a quote from Segura, the court says they're confronting a situation where, quote, the initial warrantless entry and the limited security search were not justified by exigent circumstances and were therefore illegal. But then they go on to say that securing the dwelling isn't in itself an unreasonable seizure and you just can't search. I mean, I realize this is angels dancing on the head of a pin, but that's the Fourth Amendment, right? So,
and it's actually important from Ms. Etchen's point of view, not so much her co-defendants, because when the police initially came in, they found another woman there with some marijuana that was clearly in Ms. Etchen's view.
But they don't. But the issuing judge doesn't ever hear about that marijuana, does he?
No, but from Ms. Etchen's point of view, it makes a huge difference because in Segura, they talked about, in other cases they've discussed, when they made the initial entry, the things that they found may or may not be admissible evidence. Once we get the warrant and we come back, this is admissible evidence. And I think, while I don't necessarily agree with that being a good policy, it's the law. But in Ms. Etchen's case, it's hugely important because the things the police found when they came in were things that they could have possibly convicted her of operating a drug house on, and then later on at sentencing, we would have been in a position where we would have had the preponderance standard for the crack cocaine that was found, which Ms. Etchen denied knowing was located in the house at the time. And so it changed our position from being able to try a case to a case where we could not, because we couldn't take the risk on the preponderance standard for the rest of the evidence.
Well, you're going on from saying that this entry was not off, was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, to saying that drugs have to be suppressed. I'm not at all sure of the second part of that, but
you know,
I think
Your Honor,
you got a pretty good case on the entry part.
Okay. I think that they need to be suppressed, and I think that the reason why should be apparent to you as judges. If I were a judge and I had an officer call me at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, you know, I believe we have probable cause for a search warrant, and I'd like you to meet with me, judge, so I can get a search warrant, I can't imagine a police officer having the courage to do that after this case, because essentially what this case says is if you believe you have probable cause, go in, get the house, get a hold of the judge in the morning. The police no longer need a search warrant if this is the state of the law.
There's in Segura, it took 24 hours to get the search warrant, and the Supreme Court authorized the police to secure the residence, not just the exterior of the residence, but the interior of the residence, right, and remove its occupants, and then waited 24 hours until the search warrant issued, and the court said that's okay.
But there was a huge factual difference in that case, because they had him outside of an apartment within view. I mean, there was a real...
Right, but they didn't have consent to enter in Segura either.
No, but it was a case where the police had arrested this person right outside, and there was a reasonable possibility that it would have been observed by somebody inside. And so while they didn't find that there were exigent circumstances, but it wasn't like this case where there was...
This is not an exigent circumstances case.
Right. But this is a case where the police made a decision not to get a warrant long before they entered the house. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Delia. Mr. Corneo?
May it please the court, counsel. Reed Coney appearing for Albert Cole, and making arguments in regards to acceptance responsibility after a long and drawn-out hearing on relevant conduct. I want to touch on the facts a little bit real quickly. I know I don't have much time, but in this case we had four informants all seeking Rule 35 downward departures, all sitting on extremely long prison terms, and none of these defendants had really mentioned Mr. Cole or Mr. Bowman much prior till and when they were initially arrested, and all this kind of worked itself out as months went by. The testimony of the four, and most importantly, the testimony of these four informants, these four prisoners who are seeking Rule 35, was basically the grounds for 100%, at least in Mr. Coleman's case, of the weight attributed to them. Now,
Could I just say, though, I mean, as I understand it, the district court denies acceptance of responsibility for Mr. Cole because it concludes that he's frivolously denied the amount of crack attributed to him. So that kind of takes you back into that amount determination. But you've got layers of clear error review that you're fighting, don't you? I mean,
yes.
The court finds by a clear error, you know, our review is for clear error both of those levels.
Yes.
So how can we say, despite the unsavory nature of the people who were testifying about quantities, that that this was clear error?
Well, first off, let's go to the frivolous. There's, you know, the Kusta case, and there was a frivolous denial of amounts because co-conspirators were involved. People, this was something that happened between January of 99 and August of 99. Now, Mr. Cole's case, we're talking years and years. We're talking a decade worth of informant testimony. And memories fade. Mr. Cole's memory faded. And specifically, this court has said in Robinson and in Galbraith that when Reaching a sentencing determination, a court should see if the amounts alleged include a sufficient indication of reliability to support the finding. And it is also going to say, and quote, we think it is not a terribly bad idea to do so when the witness is giving, the witness is going to provide the basis for 97% of the defendant's relevant conduct. That's Robinson. Basically, in Paul, Mr. Bowman, we were doing what the court suggested was the best scenario to do. When you have informants who are providing information that is going to greatly affect the relevant conduct, and there is issues about that relevant conduct, and throughout the testimony, this wasn't hard and fast. The arguments or the testimony of the four informants didn't match up completely.
No, it didn't, but I think what bothered the district court judge was that Mr. Cole was trying to convey the idea that he really played an extremely minimal role in this, and the district court didn't think he did play such a small role. He cooked for them for years, and that trying to minimize was inconsistent with the concept of accepting responsibility.
Well, trying to minimize, he was trying to get an exact amount, and the amount that the government, basically what happens here is the government gets to decide what the relevant conduct is, and if the defendant doesn't kowtow to that, then they lose accepted responsibility. Well, this court has said that's not the case. That's not the case.
Put that starkly, I think you're right, but we'll see how it applies to these facts. All right, thank you very much, Mr. Cornea. Mr. Geyer.
Morning, Your Honors. David Geyer on behalf of Maurice Bowman. My co-counsel hit on some things, so I just want to touch on a few issues that were raised by the court and then hopefully put some light on them. First with Segura, as we're talking about whether or not the police had probable cause and whether or not Segura applies, obviously Fourth Amendment cases are fact-specific. And Segura, the police had observed what they believed to be a drug transaction, a criminal activity. Here, what you've got is you've got police officers going, talking to a snitch, basically enticing the snitch to give them information. And if you just take a look at the search warrant itself, the argument by the government is that the police were going to go get this search warrant anyway. But the search warrant sets out that they drove this confidential informant to the Russet Road. They showed the confidential informant, took him and showed him photographs of Ms. Etchen and Mr. Bowman. And then following that information, the police then went and talked to Ms. Etchen and knocked on the door. So factually, we're different than Segura, where the police had this independent knowledge of their own. In other words, they had observed something. Here, they get a snitch who lies to them, and then they go ahead and do this. So
they do corroborate a certain amount of what Mr. Banks was telling them.
Oh, but that's real life. I mean, you live in a neighborhood, you know who somebody is, you know who somebody else is, and you know where somebody lives. I mean, there's
You get it's the support or the order somehow that links Ms. Etchen and Mr. Bowman together.
That's correct. But again, that's common knowledge in the neighborhood. I mean, he was from the neighborhood. It wasn't that Mr. Banks or the confidential informant had just walked in from Chicago and had only been there one time. There's nothing to show he's not someone from the neighborhood. And so the police, by knocking on the door and then adding in there, and to me the critical part is, as officers did so to prevent the destruction of evidence. They are telling the court at that time that there's evidence there. Now, whether it's not, there is or there isn't, but they're telling the court that they took this action to prevent the destruction of evidence. The only basis for any knowledge that they have comes from Mr. Banks. So the officers are telling the judge, we know there's evidence there, but you can't bootstrap it by saying the reason we've got the evidence is because, oh, the confidential informant, who lied to us on several occasions while we're talking to him, has now provided us information, who wants a pass, who, you know, finally gets protection for his family, despite there's nothing to show in anywhere that Mr. Bowman or Ms. Etchens or anyone had threatened him on any basis. So, again, factually, this takes it out of that. And to say that then there's an independent source, the affidavit doesn't create an independent source. The affidavit ties in what the confidential informant has done down to the point that then the officers take their action based on that. They create...
I agree. agree with you to the extent you're saying that this is not an independent source case, but I think much like what Judge Sykes was saying, this looks to me like a pretty straightforward Segura entry. You know, they have reason to believe from both banks, who they eventually think begins to tell them the truth, and their corroboration of banks, that there very likely are drugs in that place, so they want to secure it while they go off and get a warrant.
But again, as you indicated, it's angels dancing on the needle, because again, it is fact specific. If you take a look at Segura and some of the cases along those lines, the police have their own information. They've observed things. Mm-hmm. This takes you one step removed to somebody who's they have known has just committed a crime, because they've gone into the confidential informant's house and they find drugs in his setting. They now have a reason to entice him to turn over somebody else. Nothing in the affidavit says anything that they observed Mr. Bowman doing anything with drugs, that they had any concern that he was out there, you know, that they had visually seen him, hand-to-hand transactions, suspicious activity. The only suspicious activity comes through the confidential informant. Then switching quickly just to the court's notice that, yes, the district court has the discretion, and it's abuse of discretion is what you're looking at when she's listening to witnesses. The problem is, as Mr. Cornea noted, is that you're provided in a pre-sentence investigation report with the facts, namely this is the amount of drugs that are there, and then the only way you can fight that is to, you know, do it. The problem, again, with this is that maybe it's because this has been around so long and the guidelines have been there, but people who lie to the government, not only lie to the government, lied in plea questionnaires, lie, you know, they, you know, we're going to tell us everything and now come back later trying to get a Rule 35. When they start dumping on the amounts of money, and the district court made a nice comment. She said, well, I've noticed that, you know, take somebody like Bernie Madoff, who you can't just, you know, understand how he does that stuff. Bernie Madoff lived like a multimillionaire. These guys lived in poverty, they lived with no money, they lived with no assets, and the belief that there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of transactions when they don't buy cars, they don't buy homes, there's no place where this money goes, I think that the court should take a hard look at those type of responses from people and take a hard look at how those numbers come out of the air, because, again, they don't keep books, they don't keep logs, they don't keep customer lists. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Geyer. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning. Tim O'Shea for the United States. Let's start off first talking about Collins right away.
I was going to suggest that.
Well, you know, there's a huge difference.
I'd like to just ask this question. First of all, doesn't Collins cover these facts almost completely, except that in Collins, of course, when they went in, they grabbed the drugs, so the drugs were suppressed. In this case, I'm not at all sure the drugs ought to be suppressed. In fact, my inclination is that they should not be, because I think they were legally taken as a result of the search warrant and so forth. But that still leaves us with this entry problem, and Collins is heads off. It says just because you're concerned about this isn't a good enough excuse. You got to hear some activity behind the door that might let you know that somebody's getting rid of these drugs and before you can go in. So I'd like to hear something about that. I think Collins is I don't know what to do with that in this case.
Well, Collins, let's talk about it. Collins, the big thing in Collins is what did the officers do? They didn't just knock in the door and for some reason the prosecutor, when he was down here arguing to the court, had the idea that a search warrant wasn't required either, which astounded me. They search without a warrant. That's the fundamental difference between Collins on one hand and Segura, Sheets, that this court talks about, and the Alexander case that I'm going to file a 28J on that came out after my brief.
No, but
was due.
I mean, the whole discussion in Collins is about going in to keep the people from disposing of the drug.
Right.
What the case purports to be all about, and so is this case.
That's true. That's absolutely true. But I'm going to disagree a little bit with Judge Wood. This isn't about dancing on the head of the pin. The Fourth Amendment clearly protects two distinct, separate, important interests. the possessory interest, that is the seizure, the right, citizen's rights against seizure, and also the search, that is the interference with possessory interest.
Now, Mr. O'Shea, I have to intervene, though. I mean,
yes,
there is a common sense concept of the Fourth Amendment, which Segura may not be consistent with, but put Segura off to one side.
Right.
I think if you went and asked any person wandering through the lobby of this courthouse, can the police show up at your house at 11:30 at night and come in against your wishes where you have specifically told them they may not come in? And I think they all think you can't, only if the police have a warrant. Now, maybe Segura has drawn these distinctions that I believe are rather finely grained, but I think a lot of people understand the right of the people to be secure in their homes, et cetera, as if I tell the police you can't come back until you have a warrant, the police can't come back until they have a warrant.
Right. In that, you're but, precisely
but
right.
That's what happens here. You know, they knock on the door. She opens the door. She says, you can't come in. You don't have a warrant. They say, you're right. We don't have a warrant. And in they charge.
Right. Right. And as the court points out, Segura says it's okay to freeze it. Alexander says it's okay to freeze it. But you're right. So that's why we care a lot about, obviously, under the Fourth Amendment, about the reasonableness. We ask ourselves, were the cops reasonable here in this case? So I know Segura doesn't require it. Alexander doesn't require it. Sheets doesn't require it. But I think we ask ourselves, it's sort of a gut level, were the police reasonable in acting as they did? Well, as the court points out, it's perfectly okay to knock on the door and ask to come in, talk to Ms. Etchin. I think Ms. Etchin, if Mr. Delia has a chance, does she regret her decision not to cooperate? I suspect so. But in any event, she made her choice. She says, no way. She reacts quite belligerently. What did the police do? They said, we are freezing the location. And that's what all the cases Segura and on say. It's okay to freeze. And as Segura points out,
Collins certainly doesn't say that.
The problem in Collins, Your Honor, wasn't the seizure. It was the search. Not only did they knock into the door, then they started tossing the place.
I agree that the outcome, result of that is that the bottom line here is that probably the drugs don't have to be suppressed. But that doesn't mean you violated the Collins rule.
Right. I respectfully suggest that had the officers in Collins entered in Mr. McNeil's apartment in the unreasonable way they did, but had they just sat there, it would have been fine, waiting for the search warrant. That's not what they did. But what's our situation here? We know Mr. Banks was questioned in the very neighborhood where the search warrant was ultimately executed. We know that Mr. Banks made a telephone call to Mr. Bowman, showing that these two men knew each other, that Mr. Banks was going to deliver something. We know now it would have been the proceeds from the crack cocaine sales to Mr. Bowman. Mr. Bowman agreed to meet with him. And we know that Detective Reitzler heard a man's voice inside Ms. Etchin's apartment. The whole point about a cell phone, where Mr. Banks called Mr. Bowman on his cell phone, is that it's not tied to any particular address. The police didn't know where he was. And as the court observed, boy, if the cat wasn't out of the bag, they come in, they ask if she will cooperate concerning Mr. Bowman. The cat was out of the bag, clearly. The officers did act reasonably in securing the apartment to preserve the status quo. I got to tell you, Judge Wood, you alluded to this. All the flushables would have been gone from Mrs. Etchin's apartment. It would have anything that the
but
pot, the crack.
In every drug case, I think the trouble that we have is if that's enough to justify letting the police just go into somebody's apartment against their will as soon as the police have some suspicion that there are drugs there, then you really are, you know, as Collins is suggesting and other things, really running up against Fourth Amendment commands. How do you draw the line? There's almost always going to be the risk of anything that's flushable being disposed of.
Right. Well, I think that
or tossed out a window or whatever happens to it.
You know, the Fourth Amendment requires reasonableness. And the police, if they are behaving responsibly, they listen to what the Supreme Court says. And the Supreme Court has said, this is reasonable. If you have probable cause to search a place, it's reasonable to preserve the status quo. So that ties into good faith and in all the rest. But the bottom line is the police just did what the Supreme Court unambiguously in this court has said they can do. So, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to my colleagues or you know, when talking about the Fourth Amendment, it's on some level, it's just because the Supreme Court says so, and that's the way it is here. That the police acted reasonably every step. And I respectfully submit that the seizure was reasonable, both under Segura and just common sense, and that the search was supported by more than adequate probable cause.
Would you agree that it would have violated these lines if the police had relied on any information they gleaned from entering the apartment when they, a couple hours later, get the warrant from the state court judge?
Well, the
we know that they don't say anything about the marijuana, but I think it's Mr. Bowman who argues that they do take some advantage of information like the layout of the apartment and some other subsidiary details.
It's just that one detail, and then the question is whether that really affected the probable cause determination. In the question of Segura is whether there was probable cause at the time of the seizure. And I respectfully submit that there was probable cause at the time of the seizure. The best evidence of that probable cause is, in fact, the affidavit. But the layout is a minimal factor.
So you'd handle that almost like you would a Franks issue then, just say, let's take away whatever they learned through the Segura entry and see if there's probable cause left over. And if there is, then it's all okay?
I think we have to do it precisely that way, because sometimes we have to apply the Segura analysis in the context of no search warrant at all, where there's not a piece of paper to look at, and then we just evaluate based on testimony or the record, whatever, whether or not probable cause existed at the time the officers entered. So the answer is yes. The case that supports that analysis would be the Alexander case that I mentioned that I ship up a 28-J on. And, you know, there are five reasons that Mr. Banks's information was reliable, that it did establish probable cause. And we use, of course, the Farmer test that this court has articulated. There are a number of factors: corroboration, firsthand observation, the detail, the specificity, the recency. It's all in there. Mr. Banks talked about how he personally saw the crack cocaine there, how he saw where the defendant, Mr. Bowman, hid it, the Crown Royal bag, the other stuff in there.
But Mr. Banks was new to these particular police officers?
He was. Mr. Banks was a new actor. But, you know, the thing I'd like to talk about in the other, I guess, sort of the Farmer factors, I think are pretty clearly articulated in the warrant itself, and I address them, I hope, fairly well in my brief. I think we should talk for just a minute about the penal interest. It was made very clear, these statements were against Mr. Banks's penal interest. I note on page 9 of my brief how, you know, the conversation between Mr. Banks and Detective Wegner was recorded. Mr. Banks just flat out says towards the end of the conversation, "So I'm gone, huh?" And the detective says, "Yeah, doesn't look good. And he knew he was going to prison. There's no dispute that this gentleman, Mr. Banks, had been on federal supervised release out of Milwaukee, originally out of Milwaukee. There's no dispute that he was caught with a significant amount of crack cocaine. It is clear enough in the warrant that he had dealt 8 ounces over the prior 6 weeks, which in Madison, Wisconsin, is a significant retail-level crack cocaine dealer. We have to look at this reliability from Mr. Banks's perspective. It's important to consider that he faced revocation and, you know, a 5-year minimum mandatory possibility of additional charges. A person in Mr. Banks's position has the strongest possible incentive to send the police to the right place, right? He doesn't want to send the police on a wild goose chase. A person would be crazy to do that. You put it the other way. A person has the strongest disincentive, a person in Mr. Banks' position, has the strongest disincentive to send the police on a wild goose chase, unless he really, really liked the prison environment, to send the police out to wait, sit in a house for hours on end while a search warrant's being, prepared, and then, the police search finding nothing. You know, I think Mr. Banks would reasonably recognize that the police would be rather crabby with him if he had sent them on a wild goose chase. So it wasn't just against his penal interest, but he had the strongest possible incentive, and that's obvious from the warrant, to send them to the right place.
Well, to the extent that the analysis is coextensive with the warrant application, we give substantial deference to Judge Fiedler's superior position to evaluate it under McIntyre. I mean, it's not de novo review. It's a very
yeah.
deferential standard
right.
of review.
Right, right, right. So, you know, and unless there are further questions, I just simply ask that the district court's determinations, sentencing and suppression-wise, be affirmed. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. O'Shea. Now, I think for defense counsel, you all ran out of time. I'm willing to give you a minute if you have anything you would like to add.
That is the key word. Did the police need to rush into her home to preserve the status quo? They did not. They simply did not. And the Collins court warned the police take the risk in proceeding in such a fashion because the emergency may not materialize, the occupant might calmly open the door
and
ask where is the warrant.
Collins was an exigent circumstances case, a warrantless search. This is a different issue in this case. This is a Segura seizure.
It was a knock and talk, just like this was.
Oh, I understand that, but they proceeded without a warrant and searched the place.
Right.
And so the analysis is very different. It needed to be justified under the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement, and it was not. It's a very different case.
But I think, Your Honor, the reason with this that Mr. O'Shea talked about is if there's no rush, if there's no fear that evidence is going to be destroyed, why would you go into somebody's home at 11:30 at night?
That's not the standard under Segura. Segura is a bright-line rule. Says the police can secure the premises, including entering without consent, while a warrant is being applied for, and hold off on the search until the warrant materializes, and that's exactly what they did here.
And then secondly, the strongest possible incentive for Mr. Banks was to send the police someplace where they would find something. And quite honestly, if I were in Mr. Banks' position, I would send them every place I could possibly send them and hope that they found something. Someone in Mr. Banks' position is not reliable, especially after spending literally most of an hour lying to the police. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Delue.
Since Mr. O'Shea did not touch
on my... All right. Thank you, Mr. Cornea. Mr. Geyer, anything further? I'll give you a minute.
Just a few things. Again, it goes back to Segura does require, though, probable cause to begin with. And, again, Mr. O'Shea talked about cats out of the bag. Well, who opens the bag in this case? The police have Mr. Banks call Mr. Bowman. There's no discussion about drug transactions. In fact, Mr. Bowman says, I'm not there. I'm someplace else. I'm not going there tonight. So to say then that and add that into the fact that you need to then go knock on the door and create the fear that there's going to be drugs being destroyed when nothing before that was known that there was any first drugs there other than Mr. Banks, as well as there's going to be any destruction of any drugs while they went and got a search warrant. So by going knocking on the door and then under the guise of claiming, oh, we have now not exigent circumstances, but we have probable cause, and therefore we now can go in and seize this place while we go get stuff, they've created the police have created the opening of the bag, not Mr. Bowman, not Ms. Etchins. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And you three were all appointed, is that correct? The court thanks you very much for your assistance to your clients and for your assistance to us. We appreciate it very much. And